Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. And joining us this week is Jesse Balmer, state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter at Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Laura.
Happy Monday.
And Andrew Tobias, state reporter for Signal Statewide. Welcome back, Andrew.
Extra happy Monday with the time change.
No, it's not. I'm so behind. Okay. Anyway, Governor DeWine, in a statement last week, said Intel's commitment to Central Ohio extends beyond the billions in CHIPS Act funding. His statement came after the news of massive project delays in Licking County. It'll be delayed again by several years, again. And it also followed remarks that President Trump made during his address to Congress. President Trump called the CHIPS Act, which provided the lion's share of funding for the $28 billion project in Licking County, a horrible, horrible thing. He went on to say this.
You should get rid of the CHIPS Act and whatever's left over, Mr. Speaker, you should use it to reduce debt or any other reason you want to.
So I found it interesting. You know, obviously everyone applauded, including Vice President J.D. Vance. He stood and applauded. He wasn't quite a senator when the CHIPS Act passed, but it was the number one economic development project in his home state. You know, it was a big deal that we landed it. What did you make of President Trump, you know, saying that we should eliminate the CHIPS Act right there in front of the national audience?
Yeah, I think he's been skeptical of the CHIPS Act. This is something that passed with bipartisan support under his predecessor, President Joe Biden, and it has been slow to get moving. There was a lot of concern in Ohio about the funding. It took quite some time to get released to Intel, and so we haven't really seen the full fruits of this effort. But it was really one of those factors that attracted Intel to the state of Ohio. So there's just so much up in the air with this project. You mentioned the delays that are on board, in part, you know, because of Intel's financial situation. Ohio has chipped in a tremendous amount of money as well, and right now doesn't look like it's going to claw it back. So there's just like a lot going on with Intel right now.
Yeah, Laura, I mean, Intel is delayed again, but Governor DeWine is still standing behind the project.
Yeah, so it was supposed to open this year, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. Groundbreaking was in 2022, so time flies. But it's in two phases. The first phase is going to open sometime, now they're saying, in 30 or 31. And then the second phase would be 31 or 32. So we are way far off. I mean, they didn't just delay it a year this time. They delayed it several years. So, they're getting around $8 billion, I think, from the feds. And when all is said and done, they're going to get up to $2 billion from Ohio.
Yeah. And Andrew, whenever you think of the CHIPS Act, John Husted, our senator, but when he was lieutenant governor, he had a key role in landing Intel here, CHIPS Act or not. But then J.D. Vance was a big proponent of it. I mean, it was a bipartisan effort to have the CHIPS Act funding.
I think J.D. Vance actually opposed it. I don't recall what his issues were particularly, but it was interesting that John Husted's kind of been keeping his head down since he got into the Senate. I think that he's sensitive about running for election immediately. Mm-hmm. He's trying to get Trump support, and so he's been on board with some of his more controversial cabinet nominees and stuff like that. But Husted's office did issue a statement kind of defending the CHIPS Act and, you know, defending the Intel plant project. And you kind of saw two reporters last week asked different Ohio officials about it, and they kind of like dodged the question. And I've seen reporting out of Washington that suggests that Congress is not going to follow President Trump's lead on that. So I think, I think as far as like the immediate future that the project, it's going to kind of continue on the track it is right now. But as Jesse said, we don't know exactly what that is because we're running 5 years behind schedule at this point.
So. And our new lieutenant governor, Jim Tressel, had this to say related to this topic to NBC4 last week.
I've heard Intel say is they're committed to our region. They're already well into their project. And we're going to need lots of chips built lots of places. That's just, I don't think anything we do anymore goes without chips. And so I think we'll be fine.
So Jim Tressel, ever the optimist, right?
Yeah. Intel earlier this year laid off 15% of its workforce, which happened to be 15,000 employees. They did early buyouts and layoffs and then got rid of contractors. Intel was delisted from the Dow. They were kicked out of the Dow. So we don't know if Intel is going to sell part or all of their thing. We also know that there's some Wall Street analysts who are saying there's a possibility that Intel will stop doing fabrication or manufacturing the chips. They'll just design them and sell them, but they'll have like an overseas company, possibly in Taiwan, which is a big manufacturer of chips, actually do it. So those are all factors that could affect Ohio as well.
And then Attorney General Dave Yost, who is running for governor, he tweeted last week that the CHIPS Act and Intel's ever-changing timeline has been a profound disappointment. So, you know, I guess we'll just see what happens. Another thing that was mentioned in Trump's address to Congress was Intel's biggest competitor, a company from Taiwan, who is investing a lot of money without any CHIPS Act funding, according to Trump. So I don't know what that'll have to do. I don't know if that'll impact Ohio or not.
Yeah, I think, like, at this point, there's just so many questions about this project. When is it going to happen? How much money are you going to spend on it? Whether at any point, like, the state or federal government is going to say, look, like, we've put a lot of money in. Why aren't we hitting these deadlines? Mm-hmm. So that doesn't seem like it's happening yet. But there's a lot of conversation to that effect.
I did a show more than a month ago, and a Licking County commissioner came on, and he said that he was confident whether it was Intel or not, some sort of chip of some sort would be built in a facility in Licking County. So he just seemed to be happy that all the work was happening.
And I wanted to correct myself. J.D. Vance did support the CHIPS Act. I checked, so I apologize about that.
That's okay. You know, it's hard to keep up. He doesn't now. He applauded. He applauded every line, but, you know, he applauded that line in particular. This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich in the studio with Andrew Tobias from Signal Statewide, Jesse Ballmert from the Columbus Dispatch, and Laura Hancock from Cleveland.com. And we're going to move on to Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose, who is running to be state auditor now, recently said he'd like to bring a Department of Government Efficiency, Elon Musk style, better known as DOGE, to Ohio. And Laura, Republicans in the Ohio House have formed a DOGE caucus. So what are they saying they're going to do?
So they're going to just come up with recommendations. They're not, they don't have the ability to cut like the White House thinks they have the ability to cut just unilaterally. This is just going to come up with ideas to cut. And this is a I think 15 members of the Ohio House Republicans are in this DOGE caucus so far.
Okay, and it's just Republicans. It's not a bipartisan caucus.
I don't know. Mostly Republican. We can say that. That's mm-hmm. safe.
Okay. Well, and you know, this idea of, you know, the Department of Government Efficiency, I think that everyone can agree there's probably waste in the government at the state level, at the federal level, right? But I think that the way that DOGE is going about it at the federal level probably will give people some pause at having one at the state level.
It depends on where you stand on this issue. I think there are some people who like what Elon Musk is able to do at the federal government. There are some, certainly those who are losing their jobs and their livelihoods, that are not thrilled about how it's been rolling out in Washington, D.C. I think Laura made a good point that they're not going to have the same kind of power, as far as we know, at the state level. But this has been a regular refrain of Republicans in particular, that we need to cut regulations. There have been various laws passed over the years where for every one regulation that goes in, you need to eliminate a certain number of them. That was a proposal from Vivek Ramaswamy, who's running for governor, that every single regulation that's passed, you have to eliminate 10 of them. So this kind of idea that there's too much bureaucracy, that we need to cut regulations, is like a deeply Republican ideal.
Well, and I believe I read this Ohio DOGE wants to just focus on property taxes. Is that a part of it?
And there's huge activity and discussions. There's like 15 bills right now that would change how property taxes are done in Ohio, largely due to valuations and how expensive houses have gotten.
And Governor DeWine last week, you know, related to this, you know, the federal DOGE, he last week he talked about the impact on Ohio of federal firings. He said that he didn't really say much about it, other than he's keeping an eye on Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and other federal offices. Andrew, have you heard anything about the layoffs at the federal level impacting Ohio?
It's kind of unclear. We know that, for instance, DOGE visited Cleveland. I can't remember the name of it, but Cleveland's the site of the accounting office for the Defense Department, NASA, John Glenn is up there too. I mean, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is another major federal employer in Ohio. Something that's interesting, I don't know how economically significant it is if you're like looking at the top kind of like highest level, but the recent Anduril Technologies factory opening, ribbon cutting kind of announcement that happened here in the Columbus area about a month ago, Jobs Ohio said that Ohio has the largest concentration of federal workers in America outside the Washington, D.C. Area. So,
really?
Yeah. Hmm. And I qualified it by saying that maybe if there are cuts, it's not going to affect Ohio's macro economy, but there's obviously, or in a significant way, but there's families, there's tens of thousands of people who work here. So it's kind of an open question right now. It seems like DOGE has kind of slowed down after kind of like coming out, you know, guns blazing against USAID, but it's again like it's just one of those things that it's so things are moving so quickly in Washington right now, and it's not really clear where this one's headed next.
Laura,
At the NASA John Glenn facility in Cleveland, they've all been offered a buyout, so they would get paid through, I believe, October.
Okay, it just remains to be seen who took it. It's hard to like figure all that out, right?
Yeah.
And there's several Ohio government buildings, the house federal offices. Those could be sold. There's a list coming out of the federal government of trying to sell off federal buildings. There is a federal building, the Bricker Federal Building in Columbus. Does anyone know if that was on the list?
Yeah, it was.
Oh, it was? Okay.
Yeah. Now, the list, it was the Government Services Agency, which is the agency that manages the federal government's real estate portfolio. The biggest building on there was in Cleveland, 1.1 million square feet. So there was that building, and then there was a building in Medina that's around 200,000. The Bricker building's around 200,000 square feet as well. Mm-hmm. There's a building in Cincinnati, a warehouse in Dayton, a building in Youngstown. So the big question is...
She did that all off the top of her head, folks.
So the big question is, President Trump did an executive order ordering workers back into the office. So what are you going to do with all these workers if they don't have a building to go to? And Chantel Brown, she's a U.S. Congresswoman, Democrat from Warrensville Heights. She's said out loud, like, does this mean that they're anticipating layoffs? Interestingly enough, on Tuesday last week, the General Services Agency had this big list of 320 buildings across the country. Then they wiped out the list. So like when I was looking for it on Wednesday, you couldn't find it. It just said that they were going to eventually list non-core buildings. So we'll see. Maybe they got cold feet.
I know. I think a couple of the buildings they had on the list, they shouldn't have had on the list or something. So they had to take the whole list down very haphazardly.
Yeah. And I think to your point, Bricker Building was on that list. And then when they rebooted it, it was not on the list. So like everyone is saying, it's very up in the air and very unclear right now.
Before we take a break, I wanted to talk about one more thing that happened related to Trump's address to Congress last week. Congressman Al Green of Texas had an outburst. He was removed from the address to Congress. So, Andrew, while we're on the topic of news at the federal level, U.S. Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur was among 10 Democrats who voted to censure Congressman Al Green. Did you learn anything about her reasoning?
Yeah, she issued a statement explaining that when I think it was Joe Wilson was the Republican congressman who kind of like seems sort of cute in retrospect that it was a big controversy, but in 2012, I believe, interrupted Barack Obama's State of the Union and said that...
Is that the You Lie?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so she said she voted to censure him at that time, and she felt that doing so now would be consistent, essentially. I think it also reflects the composition of her district. It is a Trump-leaning district, even though she won re-election in November. It's pretty tough politically. Who knows what Republicans are going to do this summer when they redraw congressional lines more. There's probably just some political calculation that reflects as well. Other Democrats in Ohio that have more competitive races did not vote to censure him. And I don't think this is something that, you know, you're going to see ads about, like, Greg Landsman didn't censure blah, blah, blah. But I do
think...
It's
a complicated thing to explain in a 30-second ad anyway.
But yeah. I think you could see this being the basis of Marcy Kaptur saying she votes, you know, against her own party when she thinks it's right. So I think there's a political calculation there for sure.
All right. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit about the governor's race, and then we'll talk about education, both the U.S. Department of Education and a controversial higher education bill. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk about all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us is Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter at Cleveland.com, Andrew Tobias, state reporter for Signal Statewide, and Jesse Ballmer, state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. And what happens next in education is up to the leaders, both at the federal and state level. President Trump has renewed his call to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education and push those duties down to states. At the state level, Republican-led majorities in Ohio and elsewhere are looking to get rid of diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. And a similar effort is now trickling down to K-12 schools. So, Laura, let's talk about this bill to end all diversity efforts at K-12 schools. Is this a new bill?
Yeah, it's a new bill. There was sponsor testimony in the Senate last week in a Senate committee. The sponsor, Andrew Brenner, he's from Delaware County. He said that diversity, equity, and inclusion stands for division.
Division, exclusion, and indoctrination.
Yep. And then he also said that DEI wants to redistribute wealth, period. So I think that DEI is kind of there's no definition in state law or any of these bills at the higher education level or the K-12 level saying what, you know, DEI is. So you're seeing all sorts of, it's just become this like broad thing to say you don't like affirmative action, basically, is what it's become. So that one's going through the Senate. And then recently I saw that the House had its own version of the same bill for K-12. I believe that there is the momentum for it. I mean, there's a good chance that one of those is going to pass just because you have support at the federal level. Also, with some of these federal orders, you have no choice. You have to end some of these DEI programs. So Trump's had several anti-DEI executive orders, including one encouraging a patriotic education. So, you have that going on. I think there's the momentum this year. There's a pretty good chance that all this stuff's going to pass.
Does Andrew Brenner's bill for K-12 here lay out what he means by a DEI program? Like, is it if the district has a DEI office, or does it mean something even as simple as having Black History Month programming at an elementary school?
It's mostly on the training and personnel level. So you have to end contracts. You can't have preferential hiring. And there has to be a system, like a grievance system, established if you're a student employee or a member of the public who thinks that there's DEI regarding something. They have to have a grievance process so you can complain about that to the district.
Does Andrew Brenner's bill have anything in it about how to monitor or enforce 600 school districts to make sure that they're okay?
But I'm guessing just having that grievance process in will draw kind of some watchdog types.
Okay. And does it include private and charter schools? Do you remember that?
Charter schools, I believe, are included, but private are not.
Okay. Well, we'll have to see where that one goes. I wanted to also move on to the higher education bill. Mm-hmm. So at the collegiate level, the Ohio House is resuming testimony tomorrow on the controversial, it's called Senate Bill 1, a sweeping higher education bill. We're actually devoting an entire hour to that topic tomorrow, so you can listen to All Sides tomorrow at 10. The bill mentions controversial topics at colleges and universities that they are not allowed to take official positions on. It lists climate policies, immigration, marriage, abortion. Do you know if that extends to the classroom? Does that mean for the university can't take positions, or is that in like they can't teach controversy on those topics?
No, they can teach it, but the professor is allowed to say like, okay, overwhelmingly the science says that there is warming going on in the planet, but they have to allow people who disagree with it time to say their position. And that's where people in higher ed are just like, oh my gosh, you know, classroom discussions are going to get like way, you know, off into weird tangents, and they're not going to be able to move forward with the content that they need to cover because everybody who disagrees with something has to have their voice heard. And if they don't, they can complain about the professor.
Okay. So given the opposition, there was a considerable testimony. More than 800 people submitted testimony against it. Do you think that this is going to lead to any changes in the bill in the House, or is the House version going to be identical to the Senate?
I think there are going to be hardly any changes. Senator Serino, who is the sponsor of this bill, he testified last week before the House committee. And that was the last question that the leading Democrat on the committee asked, was like, hey, are you open to any changes? Are you willing to make any adjustments? There's a lot in this bill that the House had some issues with last year. But basically his answer was like, we've already been talking about this. This is well baked. Like, we're ready to pass this bill. Like, we think we should move forward on it. I know in particular Democrats, but maybe some Republicans in the House are concerned about things like the ban on faculty strikes. Also, when you eliminate a degree, to what extent can you fire the professors, even perhaps tenured professors? So there's a lot more than just DEI and controversial topics in this bill. It is a pretty massive piece of legislation, but I think Serena thinks he has the support, and I think there's reason to believe that.
Yeah, I mean, it is, Laura, it is a massive piece of legislation. It's hard to even talk about each topic. Yeah. That's why we're devoting an hour to it tomorrow, but I don't even think we'll get to everything.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's this whole China piece. You can't take money from the Chinese government, although you can take tuition dollars if they're supporting their students. The unions are concerned about this one area where it very much limits what can be in a collective bargaining contract. Basically, you can't have what they call retrenchment, like when you're eliminating a degree program, how you lay off faculty. That's not part of a collective bargaining contract. And the no striking thing cannot be allowed. And so unions, I mean, you're finding unions that have nothing to do with higher ed who are against this bill because they figure they're going to come for them next.
So if there's so much testimony against it, I mean, but you won't be surprised if nothing changes. They'll just listen to it.
Andrew's publication did a FOIA a records request and found that universities, although they do have some issues, for the most part, they have decided not to come forward with any request amendments like they did last year. So, yes, and I think the university presidents are the only ones that the legislature is going to listen to. They're certainly not going to listen to a faculty union, and they don't want to listen to students. So I think it's going to go through. I think there is the momentum. You're seeing nationwide they're coming down on universities in a lot of conservative states.
Andrew, one of your colleagues, as Laura just said, wrote about why university presidents are staying silent. Can you give us some details on that?
Yeah, like Laura said, one of my colleagues got kind of minutes of inter-university council meetings, which is kind of the lobbying and trade group for public universities, where they discussed what Laura said, just basically whether to engage on this publicly or not. And so the IUC issued a statement after our story saying that they didn't vote formally, you know, to kind of officially stay quiet as an organization. But clearly that's what all of the individual universities ended up deciding to do. And I think it's, you know, Laura said it really well. I mean, it reflects that I kind of think of Ohio State University, kind of my time here, being this like sacred cow. But the political conditions have changed. And you see, again, conservative states cracking down on universities. They're concerned about them being too liberal. We saw Columbia University lost hundreds of millions of dollars of federal funding last week because of what the White House saw as their kind of inability to crack down on student protesters regarding the Israel-Gaza war. So, I think it just shows that they're concerned about, you know, kind of provoking the legislature. The state budget is happening right now. They did not get the funding increase that they want, but they didn't pick a fight on this. And I think that's kind of like the bottom line.
So, Laura, would you say like the bottom line is university presidents, including Ohio State University President Ted Carter, feel like they can't win, so they're just not going to keep, they're going to keep quiet about it?
Yeah, might as well lay low. And they do get something that they want. I imagine that a lot of the boards of trustees and a lot of the presidents probably are a little bit maybe feeling like, okay, this isn't the worst idea that professors can't, you know, strike. So that's a kind of a huge thing that they're going to get.
Hmm. All right. Well, so there's hearings this week in the House on that bill. And then has Governor DeWine given any indication of whether he would sign it?
Governor DeWine said that he would sign a higher education bill. He was kind of holding off to see what the the final bill looked like, but I think it's likely he would sign this piece of legislation.
There's a lot, Governor DeWine has said, and you hear this a lot from a lot of the legislators, that conservative students don't feel free to express their opinions because they're afraid it's going to affect their grade. You don't really see a lot of these conservative students showing up to testify on the bill. However, you do see certain conservative professors show up to complain, you know, about what things that they see at faculty meetings. But anyway, so DeWine says that there's these conservative students, and he's sympathetic to that.
Yes, the proponents of the bill say it's going to eliminate liberal bias from higher education.
Indoctrination.
So, indoctrination, yes. Okay, there's that word again. Well, also related to education, at the federal level, the Trump administration wants to eliminate the U.S. Department of Education and leave it up to the states. Does the state have enough money to do that?
I tried to talk to Ohio Department of Education and Workforce Director Steve Dakin on Thursday about this, and he kind of stumbled. And then the spokeswoman for the department came up and said, he has to go. And then okay. he left. And so I sent them a series of emails with a series of questions. Haven't heard back, of course. I think the whole idea is, there wouldn't be the money and the capacity, so they would just do cuts, I think, is sort of the envision, you know, from Washington, D.C. In order to eliminate the U.S. Department of Education, the Trump administration knows they can't do it unless there's a vote from Congress. They need 60 votes in the Senate, which they do not have. They have 53. So what's most likely this is going to look like is just tons of cuts to cut it down to the bone. But they're probably not at this point going to be able to get rid of it completely.
But if they cut it down to the bone, that means that each state is probably going to have to make up some money if they want to keep certain programs.
Or you cut, you know. So we'll see. A lot of the money Ohio gets from the feds is in special education money. So that's a really tricky one.
Whether the state will make up that money.
Yeah. And I mean, I wouldn't want to be on the bad side of a parent with a child with special needs. Those parents are fighters, you know. They're very much champions for their kids. But who knows? I mean, we've seen sometimes they don't super care. They feel like the larger picture is more important.
Well, before we move on from education, anyone have anything else to add? There's lots of education things going on at all levels, K-12 all the way up to higher ed. I didn't want to forget something. What did I forget? No? All right. This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides. I'm Amy Jarevich, and with me in the studio, Laura Hancock from Cleveland.com, Andrew Tobias from Signal Statewide, and Jesse Vollmert from the Columbus Dispatch. I wanted to talk about the governor's race just for a minute. Jesse, a prominent Christian leader and lobbyist in Ohio, Aaron Bear, president of the Center for Christian Virtue. He endorsed Vivek Ramaswamy, who is Hindu, over Attorney General Dave Yost, who is Christian. Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, I thought this was an interesting endorsement because Aaron Bear has really risen to prominence in Ohio Republican politics in recent years and has been on the side of opposing abortion, advocating for religious release time from public schools. A lot of these issues that have really become like kind of the red meat of the Republican Party in Ohio as of late. Doesn't normally endorse it, and then did endorse Vivek Ramaswamy, who previously was endorsed by, you know, such little known figures as President Donald Trump and most of, if not the entire statewide slate of candidates. So it's really an indication that people are lining up behind Ramaswamy for his gubernatorial bid against Dave Yost, the other Republican. I thought it was also particularly interesting because Dave Yost has been so involved in a lot of the issues that Citizens for Christian Virtue has advocated for. So this is seemed like a particular slight.
Andrew, does the Center for Christian Virtue have much sway? Does that endorsement matter? Does it hurt Dave Yost?
Yeah, I don't know exactly how this works with, you know, tax issues involving religious organizations and stuff like that. But they have a network of churches that are either affiliated with them officially or unofficially. I'm not really sure. And so this is a way to, you know, say to members of those churches that Vivek Ramaswamy is the right guy to vote for. There are sort of questions about, you know, evangelical Christians are a major bloc in Republican primaries. Would they feel comfortable voting for somebody that doesn't share their religion, especially when, you know, religious policy is such a key part of, you know, what they often vote for. And so I think this gives Ramaswamy a lot of cover. It's definitely something that we're going to see in ads from him, I'm sure, as the primary approaches. So, yeah, it's very beneficial for him. And as Jesse said, it's also a, you know, it's a big slap in the face to Dave Yost as well. Hmm.
And there was a lot of tit for tat endorsement things going on social media. Like Ramaswamy boasted having 21 sheriffs endorse him. So then Dave Yost wrote, "Well, I have 30 endorsements from sheriffs." Is this true? Is this just individual sheriffs saying who they support?
A little bit, but between, you know, this prominent Christian leader and then the sheriffs, you can see the Ramaswamy team kind of going after Dave Yost's base of support as the state attorney general, as someone who has advocated for, like, opposition to abortion, opposition to the Abortion Rights Amendment, for example. So it's an interesting, like, tactic. You can see how they're kind of going about it.
Yeah, I think they're actually just trying to pressure Yost to drop out of the race and kind of end this now. I mean, it's... I talked to people about this. I believe that Yost wants to run. I think he's willing to run and lose. But the election is in 14 months. And what's the next 14 months going to look like for, you know, if his support is choked off, if he can't raise money, and that kind of stuff? It's kind of easy to say you're going to run until the bitter end, and it's kind of hard to do it for more than a year. So I think that it's best to kind of like look at these developments through that lens. It's what can they do to try to get Dave Yost to drop out of this race and save them the trouble of having to have a competitive primary at all.
Okay. And then before we take a break, each week on the Reporter Roundtable, I ask the reporters who are with me when the Democrats are going to have some candidates besides Dr. Amy Acton. So I love to make you all predict the future. So Dr. Amy Acton is running for governor, but we don't really have candidates with high profile, high name recognition in some of the other races.
So I think Tim Ryan is giving serious thought to it. He did a podcast appearance with Jen Psaki, who's a MSNBC host and a former Biden White House press spokesperson. And he said he's keeping his options open, but it's pretty clear in his comments that he's looking at the governor's race. I imagine for people like him, though, they're sort of trying to gauge what the political climate might be in 2026. When is he going to decide? I don't know what the answer to that is, but I think that's the person I'm watching the most carefully right now.
Anyone else besides Tim Ryan?
I think Andrew nailed that one. I think the further down tickets, it really depends so much on the top of the ticket. So if you have a strong gubernatorial candidate, if you have a strong Senate candidate, then you might see more viable candidates down on the lower levels. But right now, Republicans have statewide elected officials running at practically every slot. So it's, you got to know what the environment is going to be that you're jumping into before you decide to, like, really go for it.
Yeah, and National Democrats are just really on their heels right now. The Trump administration is throwing so much stuff out there. They obviously lost the November election, you know, in a pretty kind of convincing way. And so I think they're trying to find their footing and deciding what their path forward is going to be as a party. And the extent to which that happens, I think Ohio is going to be one of kind of like pretty far downstream from that decision. So at this point, we're just going to sit and wait and see what they do.
All right. Coming up, we're going to get some updates on proposed changes to marijuana laws. And we will talk about more when All Sides Reporter Roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. With me this week is Andrew Tobias, state reporter for Signal Statewide, Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter at Cleveland.com, and Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. And I wanted to talk about bird flu a little bit. Governor DeWine held a press conference last week in Drake County, one of the area's hardest hit during this bird flu outbreak. He described the 15.5 million birds that were destroyed since late December, which he described it as a massive loss. And this represents 30% of the state's egg-laying birds, which we ship eggs all around the world. Ohio leads the country in cases right now. So here is Jim Shakaris from the Ohio Poultry Association talking about what it will take to repopulate these lost birds.
You know, we all sympathize with the price of eggs, and egg farmers are going to tell you they want the price to come down as well, because we all want there to be our quality protein on every plate. The challenge that we have is it's all supply and demand. And so when we are decreasing, as we have the supply and the demand has remained the same, it's very difficult for that to happen until we get back in production. So our farmers are working every day to get those barns cleaned and disinfected so they can repopulate and start producing eggs again. That takes time. It takes that chick, 21 days to hatch. It takes 18 weeks before that hen is going to start laying eggs again. So it just takes time to repopulate the facility.
And meanwhile, the bird flu is still active while they try to repopulate. So what are your thoughts on, how Ohio is going to handle the loss of all these birds?
We're going to kind of have to see at this point. We see in the grocery store, I think eggs are like $6 or $7 dollars a dozen now. And that's a direct, ramification of this. But there's some talk. I mean, this is an issue that's been getting aired out in legislative committee hearings recently. And something that Governor DeWine also said at that press conference on Thursday is that he's going to be speaking with the U.S. Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins, which that should have happened on Friday. So perhaps we'll know more about that in the future. But some of the things that the poultry producers are saying they want from the state or from the federal government, kind of whichever one, includes there's interest in trying to research a bird flu vaccine that can be given to chickens and turkeys and other kind of poultry. Although there are concerns about international trade agreements, there's some concern from other countries about accepting vaccinated poultry. So I don't really know, can't like intelligently discuss international trade or anything like that, but that's a concern. And then they basically want to get money back from the federal government to help cover some of their losses. The Poultry Association was saying that they plan these things a year in advance because it takes a while to, for a chicken to get to the age where they can start laying eggs and stuff like that. And so they're set years behind. And I don't know all of what's going to go into fixing this, but it could take years to fix this, given that this, how disrupted things have been in Ohio and elsewhere. So we'll see where this all heads. But what they were saying, though, is that they feel the worst is probably over, but also they were pretty heavily qualifying that because I guess it just takes one more outbreak. So, yeah, it's 15.5 million birds. It's almost hard to imagine the scale of this.
Yeah, it's a huge scale. And this industry, Jesse, is really important to Ohio.
Yeah, Ohio is one of, if not the most hit states by this particular bird flu. And I know one of the things that the governor wanted to talk to the secretary about was getting some of this compensation, like, backdated, for example, like, some of the money that the individuals who are raising these chickens are getting is not going back as far as like maybe some of when their losses started. So, yeah.
The federal government has a program where they can pay farmers, for their loss. Is that what we're talking about? And so Governor DeWine is saying he's going to ask for more money.
Yeah, that's okay. The bottom line.
Okay. And now I wanted to talk about Medicaid expansion and the work requirement. Andrew, you raised a question about whether Medicaid expansion could end in Ohio. What do we know about that, the future of this program, and what Governor DeWine had to say about it?
So there is language in the state budget bill that's being negotiated right now that they call it a trigger law. But basically the concept is that if the federal government were to cut the percentage match that it currently provides to Ohio to cover Medicaid expansion, which is a particular group of people who got coverage under Obamacare about 13 years ago, they became eligible. It's about 770,000 people. If the federal government were to cut the match that they provide to that, then Medicaid would the language says it would instantly basically stop covering these people. Mm. The state would not pay for it. It's a little bit more complicated than that because the Center for Medicaid Services, a federal office that oversees Medicaid eligibility and other aspects of the program, would have to approve that. But let's say they didn't. Let's say the federal government were to just cut, Congress were to cut the percentage. Currently, they cover 90%. I think every 5% is like $700 million or something like that. And so the state would be on the hook to cover that. And so what Governor DeWine has said about why this is in there is that the state has a constitutional requirement to have a balanced budget. They also, beyond kind of the legalities of it, just need to know, you know, that they can cover, they can pay for the things that they're obligated to pay for. And so he said that having this language gives them a clean slate to then negotiate, you know, in the event that they don't have this federal money that they've used to pay for this for all these years, they can kind of set their own terms of what they think they can pay for. And so now I think that that does open the door to potentially Medicaid expansion just going away. I mean, the Republicans who are not happy that it happened in the first place, but, you know, that's all up in the air. But that's the state of the program right now. And we'll see what Congress ends up doing. But it's on the table. They're talking about making major cuts.
Can DeWine just establish the work requirement, or does he need approval for that?
Years ago, the legislature passed, I think in a budget, they said that Ohio has to apply for work requirements. And so what you're seeing is a seesawing. Whenever there's a Republican president, they apply for the work requirements. And then whenever there's a Democratic president, they say no work requirements for any states. And so it just keeps going back and forth. Mm-hmm. We're now in a Republican president. I believe that we were either accepted or we were like under consideration for the Centers of Medicare and Medicaid. So it's just kind of returning to that status.
And this is not for the elderly or people with disabilities, right? Is it just low income?
Yeah. So Medicaid expansion, the significance of that was before that, Medicaid was largely a program that provided medical coverage to disabled people, to children, to pregnant women, and just to some extent, elderly people as well. What Medicaid expansion did was broadly made people eligible up to a certain amount of income, which is something like $45,000 for a family of four. So we're talking about people who really don't make that much money. So, but yeah, that's the group of people who might be affected. You know, whether it's federal cuts, which I kind of just follow a lot of the stuff out of Washington through national media. It's just not my specialty and it's so complicated. It seems that it's pretty unlikely that they're just going to get rid of Medicaid expansion, but it's hard to really say. Mm-hmm. But I think the work requirement thing is likely to happen. And that's something that the state has said they believe that that would cause 61,000 people to lose coverage who wouldn't be able to comply with those requirements. And you hear from advocates, you know, I think people might imagine it's like, oh, people just don't want to get a job. But sometimes, you know, the case are things like they have, a person in their family with medical needs, they need to take their caregiver, and maybe they're not officially on some government document doing that, but they have obligations like that. They might have mental health challenges. There are other things that, you know, what advocates say is often people who can't have a job who are on Medicaid have a good reason why they can't have one, basically.
Mm. Medicaid expansion is really helping keep some of our rural hospitals going, is what they say. Although Republican lawmakers tend to challenge that, noting that a lot of them have, you know, a decent amount of cash on hand. But, I mean, if they did turn Medicaid into like a block grant program, which is one of the Republican proposals of just giving everybody X amount of dollars per people who qualify for Medicaid who live in your state, I mean, that could, and it most likely be much less than what they're currently giving. That could potentially hurt some of our rural hospitals.
And Andrew, Laura mentioned the seesaw back and forth, depending on who's in the administration. Has Vivek Ramaswamy been asked on the campaign trail about Medicaid and his opinion on that? Have you followed that at all?
I'm not certain about that. He hasn't been campaigning on that or anything like that. But yeah, I'm not sure what the answer is.
Okay.
There.
Well,
he's talked about work requirements for Medicaid and for welfare, which is kind of a broad term, but I don't think specifically on the Medicaid expansion population.
All right. This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich in the studio with Jesse Ballmert from the Columbus Dispatch, Andrew Tobias from Signal Statewide, and Laura Hancock from Cleveland.com. Jesse, marijuana law. Lawmakers continue to tinker around with the marijuana law that voters approved back in 2023. A bill was approved by the Senate. It would lower the maximum potency rate and cap the number of dispensaries. There's other changes like cutting the number of home grow plants in half. So it's now in the House. Are we looking at any changes from the Senate bill to in the House?
Yes, I think so. So the House actually introduced their own brand new bill last week, which would keep the home grow limits at the same rate that voters approved in 2023, which is 12 plants per residence. It would also keep the tax rate at 10%. It does cap those dispensaries at 350, which was the same as what the Senate passed. So the House seems like they're going less far than the Senate wanted to go. So it'll be interesting to see where they ultimately end up. Are we just going to like split the difference and people can have 9 plants? I guess to be determined. But that was at least a pretty good indication that they're not just going to pass exactly what the Senate did.
And a big part of the Senate bill that did get removed from the bill involved taxes and what was going to happen with the local taxes. That's now in the budget. So did that help this bill move along by taking the taxes part out of it?
Yeah, I think how much we're going to tax this industry and where those taxes are going to go is a large part of this debate. And the House bill actually, it put aside a certain percent, I think it was about 20%, for over a 5-year period to home communities. So like municipalities that have dispensaries would get some compensation. That was removed from other versions that upset the cities that said, hey, like we opened our doors to these businesses with the general understanding that we were going to receive some sort of financial benefit for it. So the House bill would allow that to go on for 5 years, but the rest of the money, and then presumably the money after those 5 years, would just go into the general revenue fund, like the general bucket of state spending. That would allow state lawmakers to really spend it on whatever they want. That's not what Ohioans voted on.
Right. They want it to stay in the communities. Yeah.
And yeah. Governor DeWine's proposed budget also did not give any money to the local governments either. So that kind of follows in a larger trend you're seeing where you kind of these like perceived liberal cities are kind of losing out on state money.
Hmm. And I can't remember if it was in your story I read that there is a proposed change that involves Delta 8 in one of these measures, which I had never heard it called diet weed before, but it was called was that your story?
It was. It's easier term for me to understand.
Diet weed. Yes. Meaning weed light. Okay.
Weed light, if you will. Yeah, so Delta 8 has been a big topic of conversation. I think there actually is a decent amount of bipartisan support for regulating this because people don't like kids being able to go into the local convenience store and find like candy bear themed like marijuana-ish. So this is something that has the support, but it hasn't passed because it's been part of this larger marijuana conversation that no one can get on the same page on. So we'll see if adding it to this measure kind of helps it move forward. That what the House would do would be saying anything above 0.3% THC would have to be sold in a dispensary. There is some question as to whether dispensaries even want to sell these products. And so that is certainly something that people who currently sell them push back on.
I think that the marijuana industry very much would love to get their hands on that market and have.
Is Delta 8 diet weed, is that hemp too, or is that different?
That is technically hemp.
It's derived from hemp, yeah.
Okay. Obviously, you just caught me and I have no clue, but okay. We'll see what happens. We're down to 2 minutes left, and I wanted to just take a second. Governor DeWine is going to give his State of the State address this week. I'm having trouble with dates. So is this his penultimate State of the State address? Mm-hmm. He gets to give one more, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What are we thinking? What will this speech look like? Anyone want to preview State of the State?
He'll probably hammer in some parts of his proposed budget that he really wants the legislature to enact. That will definitely be part of it. Money is tighter and we don't have COVID funds. So there isn't like a you get a car and you get a car Oprah Winfrey situation like there used to be. So that's probably why he'll definitely pick some certain programs and really emphasize on that. Oh, and then we also are going to find out what Lieutenant Governor Trussell is going to do. Generally, every lieutenant governor gets like an agency or a kind of like a policy portfolio they're over. And we know that Trussell is going to probably do some education and workforce stuff. But he said he was going to talk more about that at the State of the State.
Okay, so we'll find what Jim Trussell's job is in the State of the State. All right, we have about 30 seconds. You want to add anything else about the State of the State?
No, it's kind of usually the State of the State is either to announce some kind of policy proposal or it's to kind of say how great things are and tout, you know, the success of the administration or what have you. So I think the second is probably likely here. But the Trussell thing is interesting, just given I don't think that he's going to be announcing a state football team or anything like that.
Okay.
I have been wondering what he's going to do.
Well, we will wait and see. That is this week. And I want to say thank you to Andrew Tobias, state reporter for Signal Statewide. Thanks for being here, Andrew.
Happy to do it.
Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter at Cleveland.com. Thanks, Laura.
Good to be here.
Jesse Ballmer, state government reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks, Jesse.
Enjoying that extra hour of sunshine.
I'm missing the sleep, but I hear you. This is All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable. I'm Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.